Lesson three. Today's lesson is going to be on pre-screening prospects, which what I think is one of the most important ingredients of not only the real estate business, but any business for that matter. In my experience, as long as I've been in the business world, I've learned a long time ago to spend a few minutes pre-screening folks and not spend hours chasing folks that don't want to do business with you. So this very well may be the most important part of this whole course, because the ability to tell the difference between a deal and a dud is the difference between success and failure. It's also the only way you can ever implement my credo, the less I do, the more I make. Some investors spend their time driving around looking at dozens of properties a month, and some even hundreds, because they took a real estate course that says you got to go out and make 100 offers to buy a house. Personally, if that were the case, I wouldn't want to be in this business. This is not only a gross waste of time, but it's downright stupid. Chasing dead-end leads is very similar to dealing with unmotivated sellers, and can be a tremendous waste of time and energy, and unfortunately, many people never really learn how to avoid it. So the purpose of this lesson is try to determine the difference between what is a deal and what's not a deal, what's a prospect and what's a suspect. I found if you spend just a few minutes getting pre-qualifying information out of your prospect, you can avoid hours and hours gathering details about a property you never had a chance of buying to begin with, but you just weren't aware of it because you didn't take time to learn the art of pre-screening. So pre-screening is always time well spent, and it's always done in the front end, not at the property, and it's like putting money in the bank. Some investors have a tendency to take a phone call from a prospect and rush right out to the house and look at it and hoping something will happen, especially if their business has been slow. They'll be out measuring for carpet and gathering useless facts even before they know if they have a chance to put the house under contract. And what a crazy waste of time, especially when you know you should never have went out and left your desk and looked at the house to begin with. When I go out and take a look at the property, I know I'm going to buy it before I leave. Or at least I know I'm going to buy it based on the information I get. And sometimes that doesn't, the information I get doesn't match what I get when I get out there. But when I leave, I know I've got a deal. There's no reason to go. Properly screening or pre-qualifying a prospect will help you determine if you need to get any more information, whether further action is warranted or not. And when making the initial contact with a prospect, you should ask yourself three questions to determine whether you can make a deal, at least in the single-family house quick-turn business. Number one is, can I buy the house at a wholesale price? Means, can I buy the house cheap enough so that I can wholesale it to someone who wants to rehab it and resell it? And if that's not the case, can I create a subject-to deal? In other words, can I go out and just buy the property by taking over the debt, not assuming it, but taking over the debt, which we're going to thoroughly cover in future lessons? That's also the millionaire maker. I have so many hundreds or thousands of students out there getting beautiful properties. They just take over the debt on them in all price ranges in all areas of the country, including New York and California and all parts in the middle, where people want to get out of the debt, and they will exchange the property and free equity in the property for peace of mind and debt relief. So can I take over the debt? And the questions you ask will lead you to that answer before you even make a decision whether you want to go any further or not. And can I option it or possibly lease option the property? In other words, can I buy it cheap enough that I can option it for price A and sell it for price B and keep the difference? Or can I lease option it, put a tenant buyer in there, and let the tenant buyer ultimately come in and qualify for a loan and create the multiple streams of income by doing that? Of course, all of this we're going to cover in future lessons. But those are the three big questions. In other words, do I have a basis for doing business with this property? And if the situation doesn't fit any one of these three models, then you don't have a deal. It's that simple. There's no reason for you to waste any further time on the conversation, much less traveling across town to look at a house you'll never own. 5 minutes is all it should take to determine if you can create the deal with the prospective seller. Of course, you'll have to take the seller's word on things like the condition of the house and the mortgage balance and whether it has any liens or judgments and other information. All that can be verified later. Remember, we're in the pre-screening mode here. We're not ready to buy yet. We're just determining whether we need to get it more information or go to the property. If the information seems reliable and you feel the seller is motivated to pursue one of the three money-making models we discussed, then perhaps you should arrange a meeting to verify your assumptions about the the validity of the deal. When I leave my desk, the chances of putting a house under contract are about 80%. And by the time I ease my car out of the driveway, I've fully qualified my prospect, and I know I won't be just collecting a lot of useless facts. So instead of being a professional fact finder, we should get into the business of being professional offer makers. And if you follow the simple qualifying procedures on every lead that we're going to discuss on this lesson, you'll save yourself a lot of wasted, unproductive hours, and you'll start to find the business really coming together for you. Consequently, if you don't do that, you'll be wasting your time chasing dead ends, dealing with people who don't want to deal with you, and you'll wonder why nothing's happening. There's two sides of the business. There's a pretty house side and the ugly house side, as we discussed in earlier lessons, and we'll continue in later lessons. We're going to be dealing with properties that need a lot of rehab. We call those junkers or ugly houses. And then we're going to be dealing with properties that need little or no rehab. In fact, some of them are in excellent condition, ready to move into, and I call that the pretty house business. So I guess we should start this lesson off with the ugly house, and from there we'll get into the pretty houses, because there are two totally different and separate pre-screening processes that go into this, because our buying strategies are different as well as our exit strategies in most cases. We'll start with pre-screening junkers. This is really a simple math problem after you understand what you're trying to accomplish and you've collected four key items. So if you're taking notes, you're probably going to want to write these down, because you cannot make an offer on a property without having these four pieces of information in your possession. And until you get them, there's absolutely no reason actually to even ask for more information. If you can't get these four items, you don't even need to fill out the rest of the property information sheet, much less go see the property. The first is the after-repaired value, or what we refer to as the ARV, A-R-V. We can't ever make an offer on a property when we don't know what it's worth. In fact, you shouldn't make an offer on anything, personal or real, unless you know the value of it. And we're going to discuss how to arrive at that value here in this lesson. The second is the asking price. Sometimes you're going to run across sellers who won't tell you what they want. Well, they just told me that they're not the kind of prospects that I need to deal with. If they won't tell me what they're asking, I certainly can't tell them what I'm going to offer, because it would be a huge mistake to make an offer on a property before the other side even tells you what they want. And the third is the loan balance. If we don't know what the loan balance is on a house, we can't buy the house. Case closed. Anytime I ask a seller, or anybody asks a seller, what do you owe on the property, and they won't give you an answer, pre-screening's over. You don't need any more information, and we'll discuss why here in a little bit. Estimate and repairs. Does it need repairs? And if so, a general idea of what do you think those repairs would cost? Because if the property needs a lot of repairs, it's going to change our entrance and our exit, and it's actually going to change the whole complexity of the deal. So I'm going to want to know the after-repaired value, the asking price, and the loan balance, and whether the property needs a lot of rehab or not. And probably a fifth question worth writing down there is the house listed? Because if the house is listed, then there's a realtor that has to be brought into the equation. Either somebody's got to pay the commission, or the seller is going to have to ask the realtor to release that listing before we can buy the property, because we're not going to go out and buy properties that are listed unless we deal with the realtor. The realtor has a contract on the property. It's a listing agreement. It's a bona fide agreement, and we can't just assume that it's going to go away because we'd like it to. So it's always good to know if the house is listed. I'll give you a magic formula that took me 10 years to create, to use, to buy ugly houses, and then I'll cover the four items that we just discussed above. This formula will never fail you, no matter where you live or what price houses you're dealing in. I don't care whether you're in the United States, Canada, or any place you're buying properties. I don't care if they're small, low-end deals or high-end deals. If you're paying cash for a property, this formula is a formula that you should use, because if you don't, I promise you, you're going to wish you had. It works in my city and your city and any city. And if you stick to it, buying junkers is easy. If you sway from it, you're using the swag theory, as I call it, which is a scientific wild-ass guess. And trust me, using the swag theory is not the proper way to buy real estate. And it's only a matter of time before your next seminar in the School of Hard Knocks. So here's a magic formula. Write this down, and I'm going to cover it here in brief format. I can't get into great details on this lesson because, frankly, sometimes in my live training events, I spend an hour and a half just discussing how we arrived at this formula. And it's this simple. ARV, or the ARV, which is the market value of the property in excellent condition, times 70% minus what you think the repair costs equals what I call MAO. MAO is the maximum allowable offer. That's M-A-O. Now, that's after repaired value times 70% minus total repair costs equals maximum allowable offer. However, MAO is not what I'll pay if I'm paying cash for a property. Keep in mind, this offer is only applicable if we're paying cash. This has nothing to do with taking over debt. This is only applicable if we're going to buy the property and raise the cash to buy it. Your offer should always be at least $5,000 below MAO, or don't buy the house if you're paying cash. If you do, you're paying too much. And that's not a guess. It's just plain simple math. Foregoing a long, drawn-out explanation of what went into the creation of my formula, here's this simple reality. Your net profit should be at least 20% of the sales price if you were to buy, fix, and resell it yourself. All your other costs will eat up at least another 10 to 15%. And that's at least 30% off the top for expenses and profit, and that does not include repairs. Remember, there's a 20% profit built in to that 30%. What that means is I want to know that I'm going to make at least a 20% of the selling price of profit. If I'm not, I'm not interested in buying a property, fixing it, rehabbing it, and selling it to a qualified buyer, and neither will your buyers if you're wholesaling it. Using the 30% number will automatically adjust the dollars as the house value goes up or down, but the percentages won't change. However, the repairs are a case-by-case and vary with every deal, so you can't put a percentage on repairs because it just doesn't work that way. Some houses are going to need more repairs. Some houses are going to need less. So there isn't a formula where you can just throw an arbitrary percentage at repairs. All of the rest of the items you can. The sales cost and your profit and all the other costs to go into the 10 to 15% are going to adjust up and down automatically by using the percentage, but that will not work for the repairs. So ARV times 70% means you've taken 30% off the top for profit and cost except for repairs. Now that assures you at least 20% going in that the net profit will be there of at least 20% of the sales price. So if you intend to wholesale a house to an investor, you can expect him or her to pay at or about MAO for the house. Sometimes you can get a little bit more than MAO, especially in hot markets, but I wouldn't want to go into a deal paying more than MAO and expecting someone to pay me more than that. We can't run our business on the greater fool theory, and I don't care how hot your market is. If you're paying cash for properties, you pay too much, you're going to wish you hadn't done this deal. And you got to leave enough equity in it for the next guy or gal. You got to give them a reason to buy, and you got to make them excited about the property. And the only way you can do that is to leave enough profit potential in it for them. Because remember, they're buying it, they're fixing it, they're raising the capital, they're hiring the contractors, they're finding the qualified buyers, they're doing most of the work. So obviously, they should make more than you are going to make if you're simply going to wholesale it. I will tell you that I've had cases where I made as much wholesaling a house as the retailer made doing all of that work. But that was only because I got good at buying at a deeply discounted wholesale price because the property needed a lot of repairs. So if you intend to sell at MAO, you must buy it cheaper so you can build in the profit for yourself of at least $5,000. And in markets where low-end houses start $200,000 to $300,000, $5,000 is not even close to enough to get for a wholesale profit. And in fact, I'm teaching my students nowadays that it's just as easy to make $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, wholesaling properties as it is to make five. You just got to get a little bit better at buying. And the further below MAO you can buy, the bigger your wholesale profit. Remember, if you get good at buying it well below MAO, that doesn't mean you have to lower the price below MAO when you sell it wholesale. It just means that you get to keep more of the difference between what you purchased it or agreed to purchase it at and what your wholesale buyer is buying it from you at. Now, you may be wondering how you can buy a house this far below ARV, and the answer is simple. It's got to be ugly, and I mean filthy, stinking ugly, the kind of ugly that repulses most people. A lot of rotten wood, termite damage, leaking roofs, overgrown shrubs and lawns and overgrown and rats and roaches and dead animals and toilets overflowing with human feces. In fact, The house should smell so bad that when you open the front door, the smell just drives you backwards. Cat urine turns me on. The uglier the house it is, the better I like it in the ugly house business. And I will caution you, gentlemen, listen to this. If your wives will go in the house, it's probably not ugly enough. So the uglier the house, the bigger the profit. And those are key words. You may want to make a note of. I'm going to tell you from a lot of years' experience, over 1,500 deals myself, 300,000 students around the country, one rule always holds true. The uglier the house, the bigger the profit. Houses you can fix up over a weekend with a little sweat and a paintbrush are usually not the kind you're going to buy below Mayo. So if you miss this very important point, you'll spin your wheels on the wrong projects and you'll get no offers accepted. You're just not going to go out and buy beautiful homes and beautiful neighborhoods at a deeply discounted price. As a rule, I'm going to give you a couple of examples here in a minute where I did just exactly that, but as a rule, they got to be ugly for you to buy them at these deeply discounted prices. And if you want to build a business, you got to build it on where you can keep finding prospects and not that occasional deal that crops up every now and then. Pre-screening ugly houses starts with a house being very ugly, not cosmetic, ugly. And the next most important item is to determine whether it's a suspect or a prospect worth chasing or instantly passing over is that there must be a big spread between the ARV and the asking price or the deal is dead. Let me see if I can't create an example here for you. If I've got a house that's worth $150,000 in absolutely gorgeous condition, and it needs about, $20,000 worth of rehab on it, which is my best guess, and we're going to talk about how to estimate repairs here before we get through this lesson today. If I've got a seller that's asking $130,000 for this property, knowing that it's worth $150,000 in excellent condition, and I think it needs $20,000 in repairs, there is no way that I'll be purchasing this house. It's very simple. The asking price is so close to the after-repaired value, I will never be able to get that seller to come down to a number that will match the description of the formula that I just mentioned here. And the distance between what I can pay for that property and what they're asking is so far apart and so huge, I would consider this a worthless suspect not worthy of chasing, and it would be a waste of my time. And it would be a waste of anybody else's time involved in the deal as well. So let's go back and recap. If the ARV is 150 and the asking is 130 and the repairs are 20, deal is dead. In fact, I supply our Mayo formula to that. If we take 70% of 150, we're at 105. Now we take out $20,000 worth of repairs. Now we're down to 85. I know my Mayo on this thing is 85,000, and I know I got to buy it cheaper than that in order to be interested in it if I have to pay all cash. Applying a little common sense, there's a big gap between the $70,000, $75,000, $80,000 that I'll pay for this property and the $130,000 that this unrealistic seller is asking. And I might caution you, the problem is not you. It is not in your offer. The problem is in the seller's mind. The seller is in la-la land, and frankly, for them to ask $130,000 for a house that I'd spend $20,000 on to fix is an unrealistic request. They'll wind up owning this property a long, long time. And I also want to caution you that $20,000 worth of repairs that you or I could spend on a property, what it really costs us to get it done, well, it looks like about $40,000 or $50,000 to the marketplace and to the average individual out there, somebody who's not really skilled in the art of rehab. Repairs don't cost a fraction of what the market thinks it costs. On the other hand, I'm using an estimate that I would spend. So $20,000 of repairs that I would do means that I got to buy this property a lot cheaper than that seller's asking, or game over. So if you think about it, just in two simple questions, what do you think the house is worth in excellent condition, and what are you asking? And then then finding out that based on what the description is, you think the house needs about $20,000 worth of repairs, right on the telephone, you know this is a time waster. So big pre-screening lesson. Whether you're buying a pretty house or an ugly one, there's one universal truth you must never violate, or you're a goner for sure. This is a principle that many do violate in their early days, and most who do make a big mess and grow to hate real estate even though it wasn't the problem. The real problem was the boss who didn't take time to learn the basics and apply the basics, and that principle is very simple. Never, ever buy a property unless you get free equity the day you buy it or know how to create free equity shortly thereafter. Let me say that again. Never buy a property, and I mean any property, residential, commercial, vacant land, any property, unless you get free equity the day you buy it or you know how to create free equity shortly thereafter. So I guess a synopsis of what I just said was, any seller who's not willing to give you free equity the day you buy is not giving you enough incentive to be interested in purchasing. I can't imagine why any investor would want to go pay retail price for a property just for the privilege of owning a property when there are so many thousands of deals out there all around you, all over the country that you can get free equity. I have students around this country getting thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of free equity the day they buy the house. And some examples are coming to verify that in my own business here. People who pay retail price for a real estate don't understand this rule and usually live in the property. They're not in it for the money. You are. Your profit can only come from free equity in quick turn business. You must get it with the deal or shortly thereafter or you shouldn't buy the house. Now, I said you know how to create free equity thereafter, even though that is not a subject for tonight's lesson. One of the ways to do that is commonly called in today's market short sale. A short sale is nothing more than getting a deed on a property that's in behind on payments or in foreclosure and then working with the lender on the seller's behalf to discount the underlying loans after you purchase the property. You either buy it cash or you get it. Well, I'm sorry, you wouldn't buy it cash because if you would, you pay off the loan. So you're really taking over a debt. Now, I take over a lot of debt on property that's behind on payments with the assumption that I'm going to go in and discount the lender, thus creating free equity after we buy the property. However, in that case, I would get some free equity the day I bought it, plus create more free equity by working with the lender and understanding the short sale business. If you want to learn the short sale business, you can contact our office. I just created a brand new course on that, in fact, that you can buy really, really inexpensive that will go through that step by step. Another way to create free equity is to learn the art of releasing liens from the property in the form of judgments and liens of all kinds, credit card judgments, any kind of a judgment or lien other than a mortgage. We can literally work with the lien holders and get them to remove them from the property. Of course, we can always discount those liens as well. Releasing the liens is a lot more profitable because you won't have near as much money in releasing a lien from a property as you will discounting it. And I would love to spend more time on that, but that's not the subject of tonight's or today's conversation. So we're going to get free equity the day we buy it, or we're going to get free equity shortly thereafter. I'll tell you, let me give you an example of one that I just did. I'm going to take a minute to write down these numbers because if you don't, it's probably going to go right by you. I bought a student of mine, brought us a deal. We partner with students all over the country, and this was a house worth $1.1 million, or is worth it. We now own this house, and that's what it appraised at, $1.1 million after it's been repaired. There was a first mortgage on the property for $410,000, and it was in foreclosure. And there was a second mortgage for $210,000, and a third mortgage for $65,000. This guy was about 11 months behind on his payments, and he just gave my student the house. Actually, I think we gave him $5,000 to get the deed. The guy just walked away from the deal, and again, $410 on a first, $210 on a second, $65 on a third. Obviously, we got quite a bit of free equity in the deal the day we bought it. Well, I didn't tell you it also needs about $100,000 worth of repairs on it to bring it in condition. But if you add all that up, you still got a lot of free equity in that deal. However, the very first thing I did was get the second mortgage holder that had a $210,000 mortgage to discount down to $95,000. So we literally brought a $210 loan down to $95,000 just by asking, thus creating a lot of free equity after we bought the house. In addition to that, we got the third mortgage holder to drop to $15,000. So he came from $65,000 to $15,000, thus creating more free equity. And we're currently working on getting the first mortgage holder to discount. They're not going to discount a lot, but heck, if I get them to come down $20,000, that's $20,000 more than we had before we asked. It didn't cost us a darn nickel to ask them for the discounts. And in this situation, the house is in poor condition, and it was in foreclosure, so there's motivation there for everybody to discount and making it easy to create that free equity. That's why a house where the seller is asking at or about ARV is not a house worth chasing. I mean, it's a dead horse. Bury it now. Jumping up and down on his chest and and you're trying to give it artificial respiration is not going to bring it back to life. If it's dead, it's dead. And any time that you've got a seller that's asking at or about retail price for a property, as far as I'm concerned, the deal is dead. You cannot make an unmotivated seller motivated. So move on quickly and find the people who need to deal with you, who need to sell, not just want to sell. Whether it's a pretty house or an ugly house, your objective is to find sellers who need to sell, not want to sell. Sellers who need to sell will make you very, very wealthy very quickly. Sellers who want to sell will make you old, tired, and cranky, and make you wonder why you're even in this business. So if you violate that rule, I promise you, you're going to be chasing dead ends and wish you didn't. Find the people who want to deal with you and whack the rest at lightning speed. If you do, you should succeed. If you don't, you'll most certainly fail. I've been at this for a long time and bought a lot of houses and worked with a lot of students, and not one thing creates more failure than trying to deal with people or the wrong people. It can only lead to rejection, discouragement, and failure, and probably lead you into another business where you'll have the exact same problem. If you don't understand the art of pre-screening, your business will not be pretty because you're still trying to deal with people who don't want to deal with you. So that's why the spread is the big key when processing, whether it's a junker prospect or a pretty house. The bigger the spread, the better the prospect. That's also why the ugliest of the houses are usually the ones with the biggest spread. The seller is more motivated, therefore driving down the asking price and increasing the gap between the after-repaired value and the asking price is much easier because the house is ugly. Many times you'll discover that the asking is close to or even below the Mayo. And when this happens, you have a hot prospect and nothing should stop you from coming to terms on the deal. And usually this occurs only when the houses are really, really, really ugly. Well, now let's discuss how to find the ARV and estimate repairs. Before we do, remember, you must know the ARV, the asking, the loan balance, and a general repair estimate before you ever even go to the trouble of collecting the rest of the facts, much less get anywhere close to make an offer on the property. And never make an offer on a property before you find out what the seller wants. If you let them speak first, you may discover that they'll take less than you're willing to pay. If you speak first, you'll never get it for any less than the price you name. You just instantly lost the negotiating process. What comes out of your mouth will determine what goes into your bank account. And frankly, that principle applies no matter what you're buying. It could be real estate, it could be automobiles, it could be jewelry, it could be anything. Ye who names the price first loses. Ye who names the price first just put big fat foot in thy mouth. Keep your mouth shut. Never tell somebody what you'll pay for anything until they first tell you what they want. You might discover they'll take a lot less than you're willing to pay them. You must know the loan balance, and the only way is to ask. If the seller owes more than what you're willing to pay, a cash offer is kind of out of the question. It's a fruitless offer, and that is unless it's in default, of course. Now, in the cases where I just discussed on short sales, if you're taking over a debt on a property, you still have to know the loan balance, but quite often you intend to get that discounted, so you're going to create that free equity that I discussed after you buy the property. For you to not know what's owed and then make an offer for less, if it's an all-cash offer, it's going to just make you look foolish, and it'll probably end the relationship very quickly. And when you're out here buying properties through realtors that are listed, you're going to have to work a little harder to find out what the loan balance is because many of them won't know. You simply cannot present an offer to a realtor on a property that's listed until you ask the realtor to find out what's the loan balance. This is for your benefit as well as the realtor's benefit. Because for a realtor to go firing in all cash offers on properties with loans on them bigger than what you're offering is also going to make that realtor look foolish. And something just tells me they're not going to want to do business with someone very long that makes them look foolish. So knowing the loan balance instantly tells us whether this deal is a good prospect or better suited for a subject to deal, which is a get the deed deal. Many times you can get the house free by simply taking over the debt and putting up little or no cash and still get a lot of equity because the house needs repairs. Here's an example of one that I did just like that recently. I write down these numbers if you're taking notes. This house was worth $115,000 in excellent condition. we got a call. I think it was on our Yellow Pages ad. It was a pharmacist call. The dad died and left the house to the son, and it had a $52,000 mortgage on it, and it needed about $15,000 worth of repairs. Of course, that looked like about $30,000 or $40,000 to the untrained seller who was the pharmacist who gave us the call. He had been over there spending his weekends working on this property, and he was just sick and tired of this house and didn't want anything else to do with it. And I can understand why. He's over there on his free time after working all week, working on this house, not making much headway, not having that much experience actually even doing working on property. Shouldn't have ever been over there in the first place. And he was looking at it like a big project and not like a profit center. So we went to the house, met the guy, got the deed, and left owning the house. And the seller even agreed to make the next three payments simply because we asked. And we spent $15,000 on repairs and cashed out on that property. We sold it for $114,900 to a cash buyer. Not bad for a free, ugly house, huh? In fact, we made almost $40,000 on a house someone gave us, was glad to give us, agreed to make 3 months' payments on it, thanked us for taking it off of his hands, and for getting him his peace of mind back and relieving him of this project that he thought he just had to get personally involved in. Only because we got free equity when we bought the house were we able to make so much money on the property. In fact, it's a perfect example of mixing a junker deal in with an ugly house deal in with a pretty house buying technique. We took over the debt by taking over the $52,000. We raised the $15,000. We didn't pay cash for the house, and yet it still met the Mayo formula because it was worth about $110,000 to $115,000 after it was repaired. Okay, let's talk about how to determine the market value on the property. If you are a realtor or if you know a realtor, this will be very easy for you because you got the MLS system right at your disposal. So that's obviously the easiest way if you happen to know a realtor or be one because, I mean, most realtors have the MLS system right in their home, so they can pull up comps in a matter of minutes on a property. Comps means comparables, and that's the best way to find the market value on a property. Not the only way, though. And if you don't know a realtor, you can always find a realtor. Many times you can pay them to pull comps for you, or sometimes they'll do it for free, especially if they sense that you're going to be doing some business with them. And, in fact, I have a lot of students that do just exactly that. They team up with a realtor, and a few even go get a license just so they can get access to the MLS system and get the keys and get into vacant houses and get some inside information on properties sometimes that they can buy before they come on the market. So the first way is to tap into a realtor if you're not one, and the second way is to find a realtor that will work with you. If you don't know one, just ask a few. I promise you won't have too much trouble finding one that will work out some kind of arrangements where you can pull comps. And the third way is there's all kinds of databases that you can subscribe to that have nothing to do with being a licensed real estate agent. We use here in Jacksonville, Florida, we use the one that's put out by First American Real Estate Solutions. It's called Win2Data. There are numerous of these databases throughout the country. Equifax has one. Just ask around people who are buying real estate where you live, and you'll soon discover which one of these databases. I think we pay about $75 a month per county, and this thing just provides us with a wealth of information, almost everything that you can get out of the MLS system except for other properties that are listed in the area. This has nothing to do with MLS or being a licensed real estate agent. It's just a database service that gives you very similar information right at your desktop on your home or on your laptop. The fourth way is to look for similar houses in good condition that are on the market in the area where your subject is. Call the agents or call the for sale by owners from the signs on the yard and find out what they're asking. If their house is close to the size of your house and if their house is in good condition, then I think it's safe to assume, for the sake of pre-screening only now, that that their asking price is close to what the after-repair value would be of your property if it's in that same vicinity. Remember now, we're in the art of pre-screening here. We're not going to go buy the property till we do a little bit more homework than that. But for the sake of pre-screening, or for the sake of knowing you're on the right track, just find out what's going on in the neighborhood and see how it compares to your house. The fifth way is if you're contacting the seller directly, you should always ask what he or she thinks the house will be worth if it were in excellent condition. And if you're dealing with a junker, This is just an opinion on their part, and I find that people who have ugly houses, frankly, I don't trust their opinion near as much as I do with people with pretty houses. I've discovered that people with pretty houses pretty much know what their house is worth. They've done a little homework, but people with ugly houses tend to underestimate their value sometimes. So this may or may not be a real number, but it's something to get by until you can do a little bit more due diligence and do your investigation with some of the sources that I've just discussed. And always ask them how they arrived at that value. If it came from an agent or a property analysis or an appraisal, remember, it's probably the as-is value because they didn't call an agent out to, well, they may have, but usually they call an agent out or appraisal out or find somebody who's in the know and ask their opinion, and their property value is as-is. So if the house needs quite a bit of work on it, the as-is value is something you're not interested in. You're only looking for the after-repaired value. So make sure you always ask them how they arrived at it. And if the seller's figures came from a tax assessment, if they say because that's what it's assessed at, then you can just be assured in almost every community that the market value of the property is considerably worth more than the assessed value. Never, ever, ever use the property tax assessed value to determine the market value of a property. It's unreliable information. You cannot trust it. And, in fact, probably the best thing you can do with a tax assessed value is ignore it. Because if you don't, it's going to lead you astray. I'll give you a good example of that. The property that I just sold, my previous residence, when I sold the property, its tax assessed value was approximately 50% of the market value of the property or what I sold it at. So be very careful you don't fall into the tax assessment value trap and use that as a determinant of what the market value is because it's so easy for you to find. That tax assessed value is right on public records that you can tap into anytime you want it. But again, do not use it to determine the true market value of a property. Number six, there are numerous websites you can go to for comps. If you can type in the search words like comparable market value or comps or real estate value, I think you'll find more of these websites that you can tap into to pull some comps on your own and you probably want to deal with. Some are free and some will charge you, but it's very easy to get comps. There's so many sources if you just go to your website. And, of course, that doesn't require any kind of a real estate license or any association with a realtor. So there's six good ways right there to find the after-repaired value. And remember, you cannot make an offer on a property or truly pre-screen the property until after you have a decent idea of what the after-repaired value is. Okay, let's talk a little bit about estimating repairs, because in reality, we can't truly pre-screen a property unless we have an idea of what the general repair costs are going to be. And what I'm about to tell you took an awful lot of years for me to learn, and I hope that it alleviates some of the worry you may have about estimating repairs on properties. Estimating repairs scares a lot of people with no background in repairs. And I guess we should be glad it scares most people because the public's lack of knowledge in this area is what creates the opportunity for us folks who buy junkers. Most people think it costs twice as much as what it really costs to repair a house. It won't take long to get a handle on this. In fact, it's one of the easiest things to learn if you realize that you don't have to be that close to make the deal work. All you have to do is get in the ballpark. I've renovated somewhere between 400 and 600 houses to date. And here's a big shocker for you. I have never, ever, not once, been correct on my repair estimate. Not once. Of all the 400 to 600 houses that I've renovated, I've been wrong every single time. And somehow, I still was able to come home with a great big fat check, even though I was wrong on the repair estimates. So, it always costs more or less than I anticipated, but it never killed the deal or caused me to lose money. I just always brought home a handsome profit on every single deal. You see, if you use the Mayo formula I gave you, there's a margin for error already built in. Besides, if you intend to wholesale a house, it's not your opinion of repairs that counts. It's your buyer's opinion. The person you send out to take a look at the property is going to form their own opinion of repairs. You just got to be somewhere in the ballpark. So if your repair estimate kills your deal, the problem isn't your estimate. The real problem is you got away from my formula and started using the swag theory and paid too much for the house. And once that happens, it's downhill the rest of the way. You can't make that one up in volume. Pay too much and there's not much you can do to break it up, but if you buy it right, you can screw up everything there afterward and still make a profit on the house. But don't worry, I'm going to make it real easy for you to estimate repairs here. Soon you'll be doing it by walking around the house or looking at photos like I do. And here's a simple system that'll serve you better than all the programs and all the books and all the tapes and all the seminars that you're ever going to buy, and eliminate any need for software to estimate repairs, and you can do it in seconds. So are you ready? It's this simple. You're going to resist this at first because it's just too easy. It shouldn't be that easy, but it is. Again, I've had an awful lot of experience at estimated repairs, and I've done this an awful long time. Most houses you find to wholesale or retail will be in the lower end of the market and range from, somewhere around 1,000 to 2,000 square feet in size, and be one to two stories. And after a while, they'll all start to look alike. Your renovation cost on these properties is going to run between $10,000 and $25,000 as a rule, probably 95% of the time. So the system is very, very simple. You ready? Here it goes. Your repair cost will be either $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, or $25,000. Simply pick one. Yeah, it's that simple. Just trust your instincts. You'll be in the ballpark, good enough to arrive at a repair cost so you can make an offer. I know. What if you're wrong? Well, so what if you are? In fact, I'll guarantee you you're wrong. So what? If you're wholesaling, it won't matter. And if you're retailing, I expect you to get a real estimate from a contractor or two before you close the purchase. So if you're that far off, you can go back and change the offer or back out or wholesale the house. Nobody died. It just doesn't matter. Of course, if you're one of those analytical personalities, you'll ignore my suggestion and go do it. Dot every I and cross every T and before you can make a decision. While you're doing all of that, while you're down on your hands and knees measuring for carpet or up on the roof measuring to see how many squares are on the roof and running your software program and plugging in all the numbers, I and my trained assassins will be all over the country making the offer on the property, getting it purchased and getting it bought, get the check and spend the money before you can figure out what to offer on the property. But hey, at least you'll feel good about your repair estimate being correct on a house you'll never buy. Okay, let's talk about some ugly house exit strategies. Most investors buy ugly houses to either wholesale them quickly or rehab them and retail them to owner-occupants. Some keep them for rentals after rehab them, but frankly, I don't like this plan because it involves long-term debt to raise the money to buy and repair and have a payment low enough for a positive cash flow. And this debt is usually personally guaranteed, and to me, that's a cardinal sin, which I'm not going to dwell on in this lesson, but I can assure you that I'm going to pound it heavily before we get through this entire course. There are other much better ways to buy keepers, and the most common is to just get the deed on not-so-ugly houses and take over non-personally guaranteed debt, what we call debt we take over subject to, debt that we're not signing on the bottom line, debt that doesn't show up on our credit report. By taking over debt, we can buy millions of dollars worth of properties. Our credit is absolutely irrelevant, and it doesn't cloud up our financial statement for some time when we actually want to use our credit for a worthwhile project. Whether you intend to wholesale, retail, or rent, the buying process is the same on ugly houses. Your exit doesn't change the Mayo formula if you're paying cash. And only on cash deals, remember, does the Mayo apply. So please remember, if I'm paying cash for an ugly house, or a pretty house, in fact, you must use the Mayo formula. Do not violate that formula. Do not talk yourself into it because you intend to buy the property and keep it instead of buying and selling it. There's absolutely no reason for you to buy a property differently than when you want to keep it than when you want to sell it. You must get that profit or that free equity built in the day you buy it. And if you're new to this business, I'd strongly suggest you stick to the wholesaling and get some checks before venturing into the world of rehabbing and contractors. For that reason, I won't be covering the business of rehabbing in this course. And in fact, if you want to know more about rehabbing, it's covered in my wholesale retail cash flow system that you can get on my website at ronlegrand.com or call my office. And in fact, it took me an all-day seminar on six CDs just to pick up from the time you purchased the property to adequately cover the art of renovating, repairing, hiring contractors, selling, getting buyers qualified, and getting through the system quickly. And that was an all-day seminar just on that subject alone. Remember, that was from the time we actually purchased the property. Wholesaling, however, is a much easier process, and it's a faster way to get checks. And people ask me all the time, what's the two fastest ways to make money in real estate? The answer is, go find a junker and wholesale it, pick up a check for a few thousand dollars, and you're out of here. Or go get a deed on a pretty house and put a lease option tenant in there. Both of those transactions can be done within a couple of weeks, and they are the fastest ways to get a big check. If you want to learn more about wholesaling, it's also covered in that same wholesale retail cash flow system. We're going to talk about it in later lessons here, but obviously it took me five CDs just to cover that alone from beginning to end. And there's 12 CDs in that junker system alone, so obviously a lot more information than we're going to be able to cover in this system. Okay, let's move into the world of pre-screening pretty houses and see how we can make some more fast money without rehabbing and without paying cash for properties. Pre-screening pretty houses. There isn't a Mayo formula that applies to pretty houses, but the rule about getting free equity still stands. If you can't get free equity, you don't buy the house. Fortunately, you don't have to have a lot of equity to make money in the pretty house business. Since you don't have to raise the cash to buy the house or repair it, you can operate with less equity and less costly entanglements. However, the same principle applies to the spread between the ARV and the asking price. Whether it's pretty or ugly, the best prospects are those with the most free equity. In other words, the bigger the distance between the ARV, the after repaired value, and the asking price, immediately you know the more motivated your seller is and the more easier they are going to be to deal with and the more profit you get built into the property the day you actually take title. The bad news is that most people who call you to sell their pretty house to you will want close to the ARV. They're not prospects. They're suspects. And you can't work with them. And you should know it immediately upon learning the ARV and the asking are close. Whack them quickly. Get them out of your life. Don't let them drag you down and steal your dream. Quit wasting time with them. I mean, I don't hold it against them. I'm not mad at them. And when I sell my properties, I want retail price. But I learned a long time ago, we don't buy like we sell. Remember, you can't make an unmotivated seller motivated. They either need to sell or they don't. And if they don't, you don't need to be doing business with them. Now, the good news is that some sellers who call you are willing to give up a substantial amount of equity in exchange for debt relief and peace of mind. People ask me all the time, why do people give away free equity? The answer is, they don't. They exchange it for peace of mind. They get their life back. The minute we go out and take that debt off of their back, they can get up the next morning and not have to worry about that property. If you've ever been in that position, you'll understand that feeling. If you haven't, you may have a little trouble with it. However, if you're going to have trouble with it, I got a suggestion for you. Get over it and quit worrying about why people do the things they do and go help them get out of the situation. Remember, they called you. You didn't call them. You didn't make them do anything they didn't want to do. You don't force anybody to do anything they don't want to do. We don't do anything illegal, immoral, or unethical. We give people a door to go through, and if they want to go through it, fine. If they don't, fine. The last thing you want to do is try to think for people or make decisions for them. But remember, it's the spread. If the spread is big, you have a prospect. If it's not, you probably have a suspect. And don't ever forget, get free equity or don't buy the house. How big is big? Well, good question. The answer actually depends on your knowledge of your planned exit strategy and your personal financial situation. Here are your choices of exit strategies on pretty houses. And, I guess maybe if we go over the choices of your exit strategies, maybe it'll help you understand when you should go in and when you should not go in. Number one, you can get the deed on a property. It's in good shape. And immediately install a lease option tenant buyer and get a non-refundable option deposit of at least 3% of the sales price. So in other words, if you're selling a $150,000 house to someone, you should get at least $4,000 or $5,000 up front non-refundable option fee within a few days after you put the house on the market, 2 or 3 weeks max. Now this is the most common and most profitable exit actually for pretty houses that you get the deed on. It's also the quickest and the easiest. Simply go get the deed, take over the debt subject to, and immediately put the house back on the market, advertising it as a lease purchase or a rent-to-own candidate. The demand is 100 times bigger than the supply for these transactions, and you create immediate cash by the size of the deposit. You put out nothing, you get back several thousand, plus you'll create a monthly cash flow, and you'll create a back-end payday for you because of the difference between the debt that you took over and the sales price you sold it for. Again, it's one of the easiest transactions there is. Get a deed on a pretty house and then put it on the market as a lease option candidate. The second exit strategy, obviously, is to sell the cash sell the house for cash to a qualified buyer. I mean, just because I didn't buy the property and renovate it and have to raise capital doesn't mean that I can't get the deed on it and immediately turn around and put it on the market and cash out of it. But you must get free equity. If you get a bunch of free equity, what's the problem with turning the house around and selling? In fact, I'll give you an example of that, of one that we bought a foreclosure here recently. We bought it... Actually, not a foreclosure. It was a post-foreclosure. We bought it directly from the bank. And here's a good example of where we paid cash for a property that needed no work, and yet we still got free equity the day we bought it because we bought it at a wholesale price. This property is right here in Jacksonville. It appraised at $445,000 in excellent condition, and we bought it from the bank for $310,000 all cash. Now, you know, I could sit here for days and ask myself, well, how come the bank sold it so cheap? But frankly, I quit worrying about it about 13 seconds after they accepted my offer. All I know is they agreed to the price. We paid them the price. We borrowed the money on a private loan. We own the house, and we got over $125,000 worth of free equity in it. And we don't have to spend a nickel on this house. It doesn't need a bit of repairs. In that case, I didn't take over the debt. We had to go create the debt. But it's a good example of still getting a lot of free equity in a pretty house. And, of course, number three, another exit strategy is, I guess you can always move in yourself. And then truthfully, most of my students find their dream home while they're out there looking for great deals on properties. And sometimes they even screw up a good deal and move into it themselves. But, hey, what the heck, you got to have a place to live. So if you choose to sell with a lease option, your monthly payments on the subject to debt that you took over must be low enough to be covered by the incoming rent, or this choice is not available. Common sense would tell you that the chunk of coming in ought to be bigger than the chunk of going out, or you got a problem. So if the debt you're taking over has a high monthly payment, probably putting a lease option tenant in there is not a good exit strategy. If you know that by simply looking at the numbers, then common sense would also tell you that there better be a lot of equity in this property in order for me to be interested in it, because my most likely exit strategy is to get the deed and immediately sell it for cash, thus paying off the underlying loan so the monthly payment is not an issue. If the payment is low, then you can live with less equity, because your exit strategy might be to just simply get the deed and put a lease option tenant in the property who will immediately cover the debt and bring you in several thousand dollars. But I'd suggest you at least get a 10% of the value in free equity to consider taking the house. If you can't get 10%, I'm wondering, why would you want to bother with it? Now, there are just too many deals out there to take less. Maybe here's an example to help you understand that a little bit better. Seller calls you with a house, three-bedroom, two-bath house in good condition worth $150,000. She owes $138,000 and her loan is current. This is not a seller that's in default or in foreclosure. The house is in excellent condition. Upon asking her the magic word, and here's the magic words, will you sell the house for what you owe on it? Better write those down. It only took me about 12 years to learn that magic phrase, which has made me an awful lot of money since. Will you sell the house for what you owe on it? You learn all she wants is debt relief and a quick exit. Her payment is $1,182 a month in our example, and that includes taxes and insurance. And you figure the house would only rent for about $1,200 a month. So armed with this information, you collect it in just a few seconds on the telephone. The best plan is to get the deed and immediately put a lease option tenant in the house for about $150,000 to $159,000. And get a deposit of whatever you can get, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, whatever the market will bear, within a few days. You didn't get a lot of equity, but you make a quick $5,000 to $15,000 up front and still have a back end payday when your tenant buyer gets financing to buy the property sometime in the future. Payday could be months from now, could be 1, 2, 3, 4 years from now. In fact, the more you get in this business, you'll learn to know that the longer it takes that tenant buyer to cash you out, the more money you're going to make. So the payment is covered by the rent. And you acquired a nice asset with no money, no credit, no risk, and while helping the seller out of a problem. She got her life back and You got a house, and your tenant buyer got a new home. You also got appreciation. Property value is going up every single month. Mortgage payoff, it's going down every single month. Your tenant's paying off your house for you. Plus, you got depreciation. That means you get to take that $150,000 and write it off of your tax on a 27-and-a-half-year depreciation schedule and literally get a tax deduction on a property that you have no money in. So it's an awful lot of advantages to buy that property with that very small amount of equity in it. But remember, in that case, the income had to cover the outgo on a monthly basis to be able to allow us to put a tenant buyer in there. The deal that I just described is very, very common and available by the hundreds in anywhere you live. And I'll bet there's one probably within a mile or two from where you live right now. Now, the numbers may change, but the technique is going to be the same. This deal would work the same whether you got the deed or lease optioned it from the seller. The Exodus is still lease option it to a tenant buyer, and this is made possible because you got some free equity and took over a reasonable monthly payment that could be covered by rent. Even if you want to move into the house yourself, you're probably going to want a reasonable monthly payment and some free equity. Now, if you intend to option the house and resell it without the right to put a tenant buyer in there, free equity is the ruling factor. In fact, there's no way I'd want to option a $150,000 house for a $138,000 balance. There's just not enough equity in there to make me want to go sell the house for cash. And remember, when you option them, your objective is to option it for price A and sell it for price B. That would mean a cash out. That means there's got to be enough spread there to make me want to be interested in doing the same amount of work that I would do to cash out any other property. Got to find a qualified buyer and get them a loan. So I just suggest if you're going to option it, you want at least a 20% equity in the property or don't do the deal. I've got students all over the country optioning luxury homes with no risk and then auctioning them off at 80 to 90% of the market value quickly and getting life-changing checks. Many of these checks are in six figures. I mean, I've got a pile of testimonial letters here on my desk right now where people are making over $100,000 and some of them much more than that on luxury homes with little or no risk simply by optioning them for price A and then auctioning them for price B. And obviously the only way that's going to work is if there's a lot of equity in this thing. And some people think the cost of education is expensive. Try ignorance. The point here is in the luxury homes, you must get a lot bigger spread than 20%. Most of the time, you'll be selling well below market to move the house quickly, so don't back yourself into a corner by agreeing to pay too much for the property. Now, if somebody comes to me with $1 million property that they will graciously sell me for $900,000, that doesn't get me excited one iota. It's going to take a lot more equity in that than that to get me to purchase this property, unless, of course, the terms make it so easy for me to get in and get out that I can settle for less equity. But if I'm optioning that $1 million house, I'm sure going to want to option it for a lot less than $900,000, simply because I know that I'm going to have a hard time selling it for $1 million. Just because it's supposedly worth $1 million doesn't mean that I'm going to be able to sell it for $1 million. So the bigger the spread, the more enticing the option deal is to me. So anytime you deal in houses above the, $300,000 range in most markets, 20% spread just doesn't excite me that much. And after all, if you're a realtor or if you're dealing with a realtor, if there's a realtor involved, by the time they get their commission and some closing costs are paid, the seller is going to give up at least 10%. So a seller who won't give up a lot of so-called equity is a seller who doesn't want to deal with me and I don't want to deal with them, and they are a suspect as far as I'm concerned. Not a prospect. Now, the loan balance is another key element in pre-screening. If the asking and the loan are not far apart, it's a good sign the seller needs debt relief more than the cash to sell. In other words, if the seller is not asking for much money, in my mind, it instantly tells me that they need to get rid of the payments more than they need to get that little cash they're asking for. If the loan and the asking are far apart, that means the seller is looking for cash and debt relief. Good news, most of the houses you lease option or get the deed on will be for the loan amount or very close to it. Maybe sometimes a little bit of cash, a little moving money, but most of the time when we get the deed, the seller gets very little money. This type of deal will probably make, 70-80% of your pretty house deals and are the easiest to find. This week I've purchased two houses subject to, and I'll go over those deals with you here in just a second. Here's deal number one. We bought a house in excellent condition. It was it's a market value. The ARV on it's about $185,000. The seller owed $142,000 with a payment of $1,165 PITI. Now the seller was asking for $10,000. Again, 185R, 142 loan, and he wanted $10,000, and he told us right over the phone that he'd let us take over the loan and let the loan stay in his name until we got it cashed out sometime in the future and pay the loan off, as long as we started making the payments sometime in the near future. He wanted $10,000 because he thought he had that to move on, but upon questioning him, we got him to $2,000 by simply asking him, what's more important to you, getting rid of the debt or getting the 10 grand? His question is very simple. I need to get out and I need to get this payment off my back. So he settled for $2,000, which gave him enough money to get out of town. So that's $43,000 of free equity that we bought for $2,000. And this house doesn't need a bit of work. And I'll bet you don't need a computer to figure that's a good deal. Second deal we did. Incidentally, we'll put a lease option tenant in that one. In fact, I think we've already got a candidate. We just turned right around and put it on the market for about 189.9, 190, something like that. And in that case, probably my guess would be a $10,000 deposit or so. So we put out two. We'll get back 10 within a few days, and we'll have a nice asset sitting there appreciating and depreciating, and I only hope that you find 100 of them just like that. Our second deal. Small house. House is worth $95,000 and it needs about $3,000 in cleanup work. The seller only owes $62,000 and they didn't want any money because they were behind on payments. He was two payments behind of $485 a month on a $62,000 loan when she called us. In fact, in this case, I think her husband got into some trouble, financial trouble of some sort, and he kind of left her holding the bag, and actually he gave her a quick claim deed before he left town, so she was the only owner of the property, and she knew that if she didn't do something quick, she's going to lose it anyway. So we got the deed on it, and we'll make up the payments as soon as we put a lease option tenant in the house. And here's how we're going to do this one. Now listen closely, because this is a gold mine right here in just one little technique. We're going to do what we call a work for equity program. That means we're going to put a tenant buyer in the property and give them a little bit of equity in exchange for them doing the work on the property with their own money. They move in, they do the work, they buy the materials, they spend their own money. They don't call us when something needs fixed. Our plan is to sell that property for about $90,000. Remember, the ARV on it was $95,000 if it was in good shape, but we're going to sell it for $90,000 in not so good shape. Now, it doesn't need that much work. We'd spend about $3,000 on it. Our tenant buyer is probably going to spend, maybe $1,000 to get in shape because they're going to do the work themselves. We're looking for a $2,000 or $3,000 deposit on this. Of course, we're not going to name that deposit. We're going to let the market tell us what they've got before we open our big mouths and tell them what we want. So if somebody comes along and says they'll give us $5,000, that's going to be the newly required deposit. But we know we're not going to let somebody in with less than $2,000 or $3,000 and the agreement in writing, very strong agreement, that they will do the work and be responsible for the repairs as a condition of their purchase. We give them a little bit of equity, and they do the work, thus the Work for Equity program. In fact, I have a whole course on that we just created as well that lets you sell properties that need repairs and make about 150% more profit on them than you would if you actually did the work yourself. It's a dynamite program. Anyway, that's about $28,000 worth of free equity that lady gave us just because we helped her out of a mess. And remember, she called us. We didn't call her. She told us she just wanted out. We gave her exactly what she asked for. Now, to me, that deal that I just talked about is, barely worth doing. But to you, maybe a home run, especially if it's your first deal. You learn to pre-screen quickly. You'll be picking only the best deals and closing on the good ones, and pretty soon you'll see profit checks bigger than your paychecks. That I promise you. So let's recap here very quickly. On the ugly houses, we're looking for an awful lot of equity. If we can't buy them at a deeply discounted price, in other words, if we can't buy them at less than 70% of the ARV minus repairs, then obviously we're not going to get any close to buying them, and there's no reason to proceed with it. On the pretty house business, if we can take over a debt and get some free equity or know how to create free equity very shortly thereafter, and we see our exit strategy, either we can sell it for cash because we're getting a bunch of free equity, or we can put a lease option tenant in there because we got it for free and the incoming payment will cover the outgoing payment, then it's clear we've got a reason to do business with the seller. It's really not all that complicated, and I know that it probably seems more complicated than it really is, but what the heck, give yourself a little bit of time, give yourself a little bit of practice. Talk to a few prospects, fill out a few property information sheets, and lo and behold, pretty soon you'll understand it. But I'll tell you, if you don't take time to learn the art of pre-screening, the business will be nothing to you because you'll wind up letting deals go right in the trash can because you didn't understand what the definition of a deal was, and you wonder why you're doing this. So with that said, I think that pretty much wraps up the art of pre-screening. On the next session, we're going to be talking about constructing and presenting offers, and I'm going to be discussing an awful lot of magic words that I've taught my students to use over the years that helps people understand why we're doing this and makes it easy for them to make decisions. It's going to be a fun lesson.